Hayes, Brill, 9. We were talking about when you got back to Ypres in January 1945.
Yes. Well, one of the things I should have added before that, really, it doesn't really matter. The reason you said, what sort of reception did we get from Ypres? Well, it was very good, and I'll tell you why, one of the reasons why. Because it had been so connected with 1914 war, there'd been a lot of intermarriage between the locals and the English people. You know, a lot of the girls had married Englishmen and came back to England. So when they saw the tanks coming in, they dashed out to welcome them, and to their horror, they didn't speak English. Polish Army Division. And they were very put out about it. So it almost as a bonus, I think that was one of the reasons that they, because of the 1914 war connections, that when we needed a place to go and stay for about 3 months, that they opted to go for that. There was another reason too, because when they wanted to fire the guns in, they fired them in from Gravelines, which actually overlooked one of the coastal part that was still held by the Germans. So any overshots landed in there, they weren't wasted, they were killing Germans, hopefully.
Now, what about the new Comet tanks? Could you give us a description of them and what you thought of them?
Everybody was very impressed with them, but they were more heavily armoured than the Comets, which were the base of the Comet, really. I don't know how close...
I thought they were Comets.
Not on the Cromwell.
Gotcha.
Basically. Because they had the same sort of engine and sort of train. They had a bigger gun than they had on the Shermans, apart from the Firefly. But they reckoned, people went on the field firing them, because they had a few hooks there that they could fire at, and they were a bit surprised that they weren't as good as we were given to understand. Now, whether they were better on HE than armour piercing, I can't remember. They've got a different type of shell for them, actually, with a peculiar shape. They weren't the normal shape expected of a shell. They seemed to come to a point, but part way down, they had another ring round them, which was to give it more of a bit like, but weren't the same as a hollow charge. It's like the bazooka sort of thing, but they weren't basically the same. But the difference between driving a Sherman and the Cromwell and the Comet was what you did. If you were driving a Sherman, if you want to turn a corner, you pull one stick, and they worked on a differential sort of thing, and you know, so you tried to lock one. Now, the Comet they had a different system altogether, where in this gearbox, which was a fantastic bit of design, there were two serving officers that designed it, Merritt and Brown. One of them ended up in the loony bin because it got so complex in the end that he just couldn't study what results they were getting out of it. But the thing was, it had five-fold gears. And if you were going down a road and you wanted to, a straight road, you would stay on top. If you've got a slight bend, you'd go down to fourth. A more acute bend, you'd go down to third, and it worked on your gears like that. And it didn't matter how much you pulled that stick, it would take that line. You know, if you wanted a pretty acute bend, you would have to go down to first gear, and you could almost get a left-hand turn or a right-hand turn.
A right angle, almost a right angle.
Well, you know. Anyway, the thing was, you'd got to study the road in front of you when you were driving one of those, and you had to work out in advance what you thought gear you were going to need. You obviously could change your mind halfway, but it wasn't very successful. You didn't get a positive drive.
Did you get a go at driving them?
Oh, yeah. Because when I went to the fifth tanks...
No, I mean at this time, or was that later?
Well, I had a bit of an instance, which I'll tell you about, which is quite interesting. When we got back to Ypres, they just started to get delivery of the tanks. So anyway, they said, we were down near a canal, And there'd been obviously there'd been an open fronted warehouse of some kind on a jetty of this canal. And we were parking these. I don't know where they'd come in. They would have come in by train. I don't know. But I just given them the jobs of backing these in. Now I've been used to handling Cromwell, so I could handle the same sort of thing. So I backed this one in, and I backed it into position quite well. And I don't know why I developed this habit. I let it up before the switched off. And to my horror, when I went to get out, there was two men in civilian clothes with Macs on and a belt round them. Very business looking men. And one of them said to me, "What did you do that for?" And I answered, "Who the bloody hell are you?" as one would in that sort of situation. And I still didn't realise what it was. And he said, "I'll tell you now, don't you ever do that again with one of those Rolls-Royce engines. Because," he said, "when you do that, you flood the engine, that level. So you're left with an engine. When it cools down, it's got no oil left on its inner cylinders," which was a logical idea. Found out after, there were the Rolls-Royce representatives, and they stayed with us till the war ended, in civilian clothes. To, you know, everybody's surprise. Obviously, they were paid civilians, but they came merely to look after the, or see to the way we handled the, which were Rolls-Royce engines. So anyway, at one particular point, and our tank crews, you know, sort of commented on it, that they were firing into a village or something, and out of the haze and smoke, these two fellas appeared walking from the village, these two Rolls-Royce fellas. It was strange, and people wouldn't believe that the Rolls-Royce people went to that extent to make sure their engines were, you know, looked after. But the strange thing was, when they first got the tanks and they were taking them up to Gravelin, nearly every big gearbox broke down.
What was wrong? What was that?
There was something wrong in the...
This is the Merrill Brown...
Yeah, Merrill Brown gearbox. And they had to send people over to fix them up. There was some fault somewhere in the... Not in the gearbox, but in the manufacture somewhere.
So it wasn't the theory of the gearbox, it was the actual making of it.
It was an assembly together. The if you could understand epicyclic gears, it was quite simple. It took a lot of getting used to, though, because there was no... It was all worked on these epicyclic gears. They worked on rings and annular rings and sun rings and that sort of thing. And what you did, you had... Instead of having a normal gearbox train, there were two drums on either side, out exterior to the gearbox. And when you want to turn, you stopped one of these rings. So as soon as you did that, it transferred that. If you locked one of these, I just forget the orbit rings or something, and it was internally, you know, cogged. And what you would do, the train that locked into took over the speed then and altered the speed completely different. And it was a fantastic conception of our gearbox. So there was no crashing of gears or anything because they were in mesh all the time. It wasn't until you held one of these angular rings and it was just worked on as if you were putting a brake on that particular ring. I don't know if it had one or two exterior to the gearbox. It was a fantastic what's name. And they very seldomly gave trouble, but that one particular time, I think the what's name. And they said, and we put back to these people that were driving tanks around Long Valley up to try and, you know, drive them to destruction. But we were always contented. They were so experienced at driving, they would automatically hit there's something wrong there and lay off a bit. When our drivers got up to it, a lot of them had never driven that type of tank. They'd only driven Shermans. They were a bit ham-fisted or ham-handed or whatever. And every gearbox needed realigning somewhere. I don't know what actually happened. But
What about the Rolls-Royce engines? How did they compare with the Sherman engines?
Well, there was no...
You know, the Chrysler and the...
They were much more powerful engine than Merlin. It was a derated fighter aircraft engine, really, the Merlins. They were an excellent engine. But we could hardly touch them because they were nearly all sealed by Rolls-Royce. They were beyond our technical expertise, and our fitters would very seldomly touch them. We could have a go at the Sherman tanks because they were built in a very rugged sort of way, but certainly not the Merlins. They were a very sleek piece of engineering. They very seldomly gave trouble, but nevertheless, if they did, it wasn't a job for us, it was a job for Brigade, I would have thought.
Did the Comet have any problems that you were, mechanical problems that you as fitters would have to deal with?
We did run into that, except that one instance when we first got the tanks delivered.
Were you there when, it sounds like the very same warehouse, a shot was accidentally fired in Ypres from that warehouse through the roof. Do you remember that?
Very possibly. But I wasn't there at the time, but in that particular family. Ypres was a strange, an eerie place at night if you did a guard there.
In what way?
The background noise, because it's very quiet normally in a Belgian town at night, in the middle of the night. It was almost like ghosts from the past. The men that were lost there, whether I had a very imaginative mind, everything echoed, because of patrolling guards all over Ypres. And, sort of the click of a foot. Didn't hear the steel of the heel because we'd got no heel plates on because of the tank crew. Well, basically, a whole lot of us were all the studs were taken off our boots and that sort of thing. Because of the danger of slipping and one thing or another. But if a boat, the other side of the town, where somebody could, sort of put one up the spout sort of thing, you'd hear the click of the boat echoing through the night. It was eerie. It was almost like 1914 all over again.
Did you visit the battlefields much?
Oh, I did. Not particularly at that particular time, but I went back after.
But not then?
No. But they had some strange customs there. Ypres Cathedral was rebuilt after the 1914 war. It was absolutely knocked to the ground. And there was one particular instance there. It was on a Sunday. And I can't remember if it was before we went up to the Ardennes or when we came back. And Elsa, the lovely lady of the house, said to me, you're going down to the cathedral to see Cat Sunday. And I said, what in the hell's name is Cat Sunday? And apparently it was a traditional thing. They had it. Where I used to throw a live cat off the top of the cathedral into the crowd, and whoever caught it got a prize or some sort. It degraded to the point where it was the one that got the biggest part of the cat in the end, which was Alvin McCarver, I would have thought. So I'm not particularly bothered about going, but it still went on. But I think they in the end whether they threw a dummy cat down, I don't know. But no, the people were absolutely fantastic with us. And of course there's still the tradition of the playing the bugle at the Menin Gate every night. I think it was 8 o'clock and it was done by the fire brigade. And it was very impressive,
Did you go ever?
I'd been near it when it was happening because they used to stop the traffic for 5 minutes to the Menin Gate. And it was the main gate in and out. And there was another just outside the gate. We had a small I don't know what sort of hospital you call it. A small hospital where they took in for minor things. I think I went in for a spell in there. But it was called, it was on the Menin Road actually, which was just outside the gates. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. And of course, then when we eventually, I was then moved on to A1 Echelon, which was a group on its own.
Now, that was while you were at Ypres, was it?
That was when
I
was at Ypres, when they formed that, and that's when I
now,
transferred.
What exactly was A1 Echelon, and what were you on? What were you in that? Were you a fitter?
We were a number of vehicles, and it could be minimal, it could be as low as six. And it would be bare essentials, which would be petrol, ammunition, maybe one of HE and one of solid shot. And there was only about six in it, actually. But we went right up with the tanks. No messing, you know, you were right up with the tanks.
So you were in the front line almost?
Yeah. But what we got, and I've still got it here, and I'll show you after. And I don't think any of the others got it, don't know, even the tank crews. We got an escape pack. I've still got the back in the kitchen. It's about that, made of plastic, that, by about that. And it got to go in your top pocket. And in it, you've got a small compass, a container for water, purification tablets to go in the water once you've got it filled. We had tablets for keeping you awake, and it was packed, and a bar of chocolate, and it was an escape pack if you're marooned. And quite a few of our A1 Echelon did go adrift because sometimes you didn't follow the tanks up very closely. They'd say the tanks are short of that, and it was almost like one of these sort of cliches, head for the sound of the guns, and that's where you went up to, you know, deliver your stuff. And that was, I think we were the only ones that got the mission. I never heard of anybody else that got one. And I kept mine until the end of the fellow, of course you got tempted, and you opened up the thing at the end, and they had more was ending them to eat your chocolate, and they found it was bloody awful. It was bitter, it was, you know, just to sustain energy. It was not a sweetmeat of any sort.
Now, you were transferred to the A1 Echelon as what? Were you a driver then?
I was a driver in A1 Echelon.
And what were you driving, a petrol, a lorry, or...?
Funnily enough, I was driving one of these Canadian Fords. I can't remember what it was carrying, but it was shells, definitely shells, and it was HE shells too. Because I remember unloading it at the other end. You know, when the war ended, we had to unload them all, because we wanted them for other purposes, the vehicles. And
were you the only one of the crew, or did you have two? Were you the driver, or the co-driver?
No, there was no co-driver with them, no. And,
so you're on your own?
You're on your own, and quite honestly, we'd be up occasionally with one of our, what's going to go up on a mine. And fortunately, they didn't go up, they just blew a wheel off, or a front back wheel, or a front wheel, or whatever you had. They weren't particularly powerful mine, thank goodness.
So, who else was in A1 Echelon? Who was running it? Do you remember?
Well, the fellow that was at the thing with the plaid trousers on, he reckoned he was in charge of it.
Tommy Wilmot?
Yeah. Because he said things to me that it didn't realise, and if he was running it, he'd know what he was talking about. He said, you didn't go up forward in a group, and I said, no, you didn't. And it took my mind that, you know, there was nobody to ask, so you thought you just went along with the flow, if you know what I mean.
Now, did you remember him at the time?
No.
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 Now, well, anything else before you leave Ypres then?
No, we moved to, I think it was Lake Age. You know, ready for the Rhine crossing. I think it's Lake Age. I'm not sure it was. And we stayed there two or three times. We didn't know what was going on up front. Then suddenly they decided that we were to go. You know, they got the... Went across the pontoon bridge to start it, you know.
What was it like driving across that? Because it's a big river.
It's a big river.
What was it like?
I don't know. You get... It's one of those things. You get transfixed and you think, oh, you're going to end up in the Rhine, you know. And we got across that, and they just crossed it the same time. And they dropped... They had a parachute drop the other side. And it was, I don't know, about maybe a mile the other side of the river and the Rhine. And by the time we got there, you know, later on in the day, the paratroops had disappeared. They were away like rabbits. Very little of their own transport. They were anything that would move, which they could commandeer. They commandeered it and went straight off into the blue. And they did some very good work, actually, those parat people, and the commandos that were with them. Because if we got to a very sticky part, and we hadn't got our support up with us, they would you know, put a pontoon bridge across, you know, lightweight pontoon bridge to get the tanks across. And a very interesting sort of situation that. And by this time, I'd gone through the idea of being frightened about anything. You got completely immune to it, so it didn't bother me. I thought I'd been on my own in virtually occupied German territory. I thought, this is going to be a bit hairy, but no, I never thought much of it.
Why was that, do you think? Because some people get more nervous as they go on, and others get less.
Well, in my case, I'm absolutely paranoid when we're bottled in Normandy on fixed lines. It's once you break out of that confined area that you learn to live with whatever's going. I found it that way. And I mean, there's many a time I took my pistol out of my holster and cocked it, you know, thinking, and put it back quick. Because that's what there were people that chickened out at the time. But there's one officer that I still can't place what happened to him when we landed. I'll show you his photograph in a minute.
Now, what do you remember after you crossed the Rhine then? Any particular incidents?
Well,
not necessarily in order, just as you remember them, you know.
The first thing was Trevor the World, which was the one that the infantry federation, I can't remember if it was the head of it or who it was, I don't even know him now. The infantry got wiped out on top of them.
That would be round about the 1st of April, I think they were.
I don't know the date, but was it the Herefords that were up on top of that?
Can't quite see it at the moment. What do you remember of what happened?
It was across the... I'm sure it was across the Dalton Bones Canal, that bridge was put across.
Yes, that's right.
And we got into the town part of it, which was only maybe... Because we were the unit we were out of behind the tanks, so... And they were waiting for the bridge to be completed. And we were halfway through the town and the Germans tried to bomb them building that bridge. Eventually, they did get across. It was late on in the evening. But what had happened, they'd gone across the bridge, mainly infantry to start with. Apparently, the ground from... The bridge goes pretty steeply up for about a quarter of a mile or something like that, up onto a forest, because I didn't realise, bold, the German translation is forest. But what had happened is they'd sent one unit up and they'd gone, not straight through the forest, they'd gone over to the right, and one of them had got through, and I can't remember which one it was, might have only been a squadron or maybe a regiment, I don't know which. But then, whoever the infantry regiment up, they were having a hell of a time up there because they brought from Osnabrück, which was behind there, a training battalion of mainly NCOs. And they gave, whatever regiment it was, they gave them a hell of a time up there. A really bad time. And as I say, the losses up there were... In actual fact, it broke down one of the infantry regiments down to nil, and they had to replace it with another one. But we brought the first Cheshires in their place.
And what was happening to you? What were you doing?
Well, we
time?
Were down. What would happen? We went over the bridge and turned right alongside the canal because we were the supply column. There was only about six or seven vehicles there. But also, what they put in behind it was, I didn't realise at the time, there was a Bofa, mobile Bofa gone. In the group, and there was also one of the Yankee recovery vehicles, which was absolutely bosh. Based on the Sherman with the torque was excellent because the power to weight ratio worked very well. But then the Americans gave us this thing, and it was based on a Sherman again. But what they did, instead of just cutting the turret off, they built an open top turret on it, and it was, you know, from the deck, it was almost my height, with all sorts of gubbins in, and a winch on the back, a winch on the front. And it was absolutely useless. And in the end...
Why was it so bad?
Because the power to... The only way it would work was with using the two winches. One to the vehicle you were pulling, and one to a substantial tree. and they worked in conjunction, and, you know, cables like that. They were very good winches.
Very thick cables.
Yeah, but also it didn't work exactly right. You eventually pulled the tree down instead of the tank out, which actually did happen on a few occasions. But somebody called for, and this somebody told me about one of the wireless operators, and he said, somebody came up on there and asked for the monument. And the colonel came off, and anything that came over the air that he was listening to, he'd check, and he said, what in God's name is the monument? He said, that bloody recovery vehicle that we got from the Americans, it's about as much use as a monument, so that's what we called it. And they kept the name. But anyway, we stayed there the night, and in the middle of the night, the German Air Force came in and tried their best to knock that bridge out. So we were, we'd be about 100 yards.
This is the bridge over the Dortmund Ems Canal.
Yeah, and it was pretty high bridge too, but they did have to go across a little bit. And they tried to bomb this bridge, and they both were having a go at it. And I never heard both work the way they did. When the bomb dropped, they'd be firing, and as soon as the bomb dropped, they'd number off the gun crew. 1, 2, 3, 4, see whether they had been killed, so that when they were asked to fire again, they'd know whether they'd got a full complement. So in the morning, Sergeant came along to me and he said, who's got HEM? And I said, I have. He said, right. He said, what I want you to do is turn around from where you are, go back towards the bridge, go down the road to there, and go up towards the ridge. But he said, before you get up onto the ridge at the very top, you'll find a link out of it into sort of an open quarry. It's been quarrying, So I said, okay. So he said, go straight up there and cut in into that cutting, you know, halfway up the hill. And he said, ask them what they want you to do. They'll direct you from there. So I said, well, what's the idea? So he said, well, we're some of the few tanks that have been left to help the infantry out. And I found out after why they didn't leave it and say, well, you know, the hell with it. Apparently we had moved over into the 7th Armour Division's territory. And if you did that and you ran into trouble, it was courtesy to clear that trouble before you vacated their space, their centre line. And so I went up and said,